Welcome to Just a Taste. I'm Scott Curry with Chef's Best. We gather to talk about the trends in marketing, retail, and production in food and beverage that are shaping the industry. We have with us today Christopher Deering, Senior Editor of Food Dive. Before joining Industry Dive, Chris covered food and agriculture for USA Today and commodities for Reuters. He graduated from the University of Missouri with a degree in journalism. Christopher was born in Milwaukee and is a Brewers, Packers, and Royals fan. There's two baseball teams there. We'll have to investigate that later. When he's not working for Industry Dive, he can be found running, swimming, and spending time with his wife and five-year-old son. He also ran to the top of the Empire State Building twice. Christopher is going to talk to us today about the plant-based meat industry. I can't think of a better authority right now to do so. His recent article, Plant-Based Meat Survivor, Which Brands Will Stay on the Shelf, captured the true essence of the absolute explosion underway, led by the likes of Beyond Meat. Christopher, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Scott. I appreciate it.
So let's, before we get into kind of the current state of plant-based meat, let's go back in history, and I don't know where we start with it. Only to say that I recall up until maybe 5 years ago, if someone had asked me about plant-based meat, which I don't think was a term itself, I probably would have just said tofu.
And
chicken-like products. But where did the history, where do we begin when we're going to be talking about plant-based meat? What started this trend that now appears to kind of have that classic hockey stick upturn to it, but how many decades or years do we have to go back to start understanding this?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the attention in recent years is focused on some of these newer upstarts, Beyond Meat, Impossible Foods. As you made the point that, you know, plant-based meats really have been around for decades. Boca, Morningstar Farms, you know, are just a few of the brands that have been around for a while. And I think, you know, you start out with the early versions of just, you know, vegetables in the product, and then it sort of morphed into looking for, you know, different types of vegetables and whole grains, so maybe a healthier version of the veggie burger. And now what we've transitioned to in recent years is, you know, while the veggie burger that we, you know, that has been around for a while will continue to remain and be a popular item, increasingly it's becoming that to really attract carnivores and meat eaters, you need to have a product that really tastes like meat if you're going to attract them over. Otherwise, they have no reason to abandon what, you know, they've been consuming for decades. So we've made that shift from just, you know, vegetable-based burgers to now, you know, still using vegetables, obviously, but making them more realistic and more meat-like.
Right. So I would say that it's probably safe to say that we're entering a new phase of actual legitimate attempts to imitate, as opposed to just straight substitute. From my own limited experience, it was safe to say that the chicken-like products, You had to kind of convince yourself a little bit that part of the meal was chicken. You just had to accept that it was, to me, something different in terms of texture. Chicken has not much taste to it anyways, but right. Texture in particular always stood out to me, as opposed to a veggie burger was, to me, always a veggie burger. You were never fooling me. And, I'm not sure if these words imitate and fool are the right ones, but that's what you weren't convincing me that a veggie burger was a traditional, you know, cattle-based hamburger in the past, whereas that seems to be what's new. And we'll talk about what's sociologically driving that. But is there a technology that's driving that as well? Has something occurred in the last few years that has allowed manufacturers to say, you know what we can do is we can actually create something that has the texture, taste, and is prepared, meaning, you know, grilled traditionally the same way. Was there a leap there that opened this new door?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would point to two things. One is just there's a bigger variety of ingredients that are available. You're able to access, products from around the world, maybe a different type of a protein or a different type of ingredient that you may not have had access to in the past. The second and more prominent point is that researchers have approached it really from deconstructing the burger and actually finding out, in the case of a hamburger, why a certain occurrence happens. For example, how to make the burger sizzle, how to make it appear as if it's, creating the oozing, that happens when you cook a traditional burger. So they're basically gone back and reconstructed, the same thing that happens in a plant-based burger with what happens in a traditional burger. For example, Impossible Foods, which, has a product out now and is available in roughly 7,000 Burger Kings, spent 5 years doing research before it even began producing its first product. So it spent a lot of time and a lot of effort behind the scenes before it actually moved forward with a legitimate product.
And let's talk culturally a little bit what has been driving this. Obviously, vegetarian and vegan is on the rise. There's all sorts of different diets out there that we may take up 3 hours to list the ones, but keto comes to mind and others. But are we at a unique place in time where we're willing to accept this? If I were to randomly pick a year of 1993, I'm just not sure how this would have flown, right? I don't know if people would have adopted it. It at the very least probably would have been snickered at. Generations, that's almost a generation ago, so you have a whole different consumer marketplace. But what are some of the driving cultural forces that are not only allowing it to rise in market share, which we'll get to, but for companies that actually have invested what sounds like significant resources into creating these types of products?
Yeah, I mean, just first, underscoring the point you made earlier that technology is available, there's more ingredients available that have made it possible now to do things that, 20 years ago you weren't able to do, right? But ultimately, consumers increasingly care about eating healthier. They care about, where their food comes from, how it's produced. And so there's an incentive for consumers to want to maybe shift away from, plant-based meat or from traditional meat rather that, has gotten criticized by folks at the World Health Organization and from, consumers and other critics who maybe are concerned about its impact on the environment. It's very time consuming and takes a lot of resources, on the earth and feed and that kind of, additive and an ingredient rather to produce the food. And so, consumers are more willing to take a look, at alternatives that they might have not have done before. And, really a big thing that's, sweeping the food industry now is consumers really care about how their food is produced, where it's produced and what goes into the food. And that is a big reason, frankly, why consumers are more willing to try plant-based meats. Now, the question remains, how big of a trend is this going to be? Is this trend going to last? I mean, I think just from what we've seen so far that, plant-based meats as we know them today are going to be a part of the food space. How big of a part really remains to be seen.
And we're probably just starting to see the tip of the iceberg of what is could be a PR battle here too, as to which one is good. I mean, literally today in the New York Times, I haven't even had time to read it, but this is the headline. Eat less red meat, scientists said. Now some believe that was a bad idea. Let's put it this way. The article just came out and it seems that the comment section, which New York Times comments and articles are usually quite civilized, but I can just tell from the number of comments that I'm going to spend some time in there seeing what people are interested in. So I think there's that combination of the science of, is it good for you, not good for you, and also, environmental effects and everything that it's going to be an interesting battle, if you will, as to, you know, different perceptions on what you should eat. I know it's one day something's good for you, another day something isn't. And, you know, it's very difficult to almost make those decisions today. But I want to talk about the size of this market and where you think it's going. So I'm going to quote directly from your article here. Again, this is on Food Dive. The plant-based meat market is expanding at an impressive clip. Sales climbed 42% between March 2016 and March 2019, when they reached $888 million, according to Nielsen data reported by the AP. At the same time, sales of conventional meat were up 1% to $85 billion. Euromonitor predicts the market for plant-based meat substitutes will reach $2.5 billion by 2023. So that's a forecast of almost 3x in 4 years. Those are big numbers. I would love some context on those numbers, though. Is, pardon the pun, but is this starting to take a bite out of the meat market, or are we still talking very small percentages here compared to conventional meat? And then obvious follow-up to that is, where do you think it's going?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that there's some concern among the meat producers that plant-based meat products are a real threat to their industry. Now, I mean, right now the meat space is multi-billion-dollar industry. So the growth that we're seeing in plant-based meats, while, you know, sizable in terms of percentage increase, is still relatively small when you factor it in terms of how big, you know, meat is right now. But, you know, you really need to take into account how the potential that exists here, because if you look in the last year or so, a lot of the big food companies have gotten into the space, including Tyson Foods, which is, you know, a major beef, pork, and chicken processor. So, you know, they've introduced their own product line. And then you also have Nestle is just rolled out last week, the Awesome Burger to several stores. Kellogg is kind of doing some work on its Morningstar brand that it's had in its fold. Conagra is doing the same. So, you know, you look back just over the last year, and it's really startling to see how some of these big food manufacturers are really establishing a presence in the space, or taking a look at products that are, you know, the veggie burgers that they've had in their portfolio for a long time, and making changes to make the burgers or make the food and the meat that they are, plant-based meat that they're producing, more meat-like and more realistic. So, you know, clearly they want to have a place at the table in case, you know, some of the numbers that you referenced earlier actually do pan out. You know, the question, like I said, going back earlier, really remains how much of this is, you know, consumers just trying it out just for the sake of like seeing what these products are like. You know, I don't think there's any question that you know, that what we're seeing now with products like Beyond Meat or the Impossible Burger, you know, I think they're going to have a place in the consumer's, you know, meal patterns and meal habits. But exactly how big really remains to be seen. But like I said, there's companies really want to be a part of this just in case.
So they're, on the one hand, there's a hedge going on here, right? And it reminds me a little bit of how the alcohol industry is investing in the cannabis industry, right? They're making a hedge on, you know, that if people drink less and use cannabis more, then they want to be there. Right. I'm curious if there's also a financial incentive, and I'll suggest these things, but I am turning to you as an expert. I have absolutely no idea. Are the margins better for them? Are they concerned about land availability, you know, to, you know, for cattle in the future? I don't know if, you know, which, I don't know if plants yield more per acre or cattle. I have no idea. But going a little deeper on it, what other incentives might there be for these companies to explore this area beyond just hedging and wanting to make sure that they're part of it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, ultimately they realize that consumers care about you know, how their food is produced, where it's produced, and you know, they realize that the dollar speaks. And when consumers go to the grocery store, they increasingly care about those attributes and the products they consume. So ultimately, they want to make sure that, you know, they have a place in this space and that they have a product that, you know, the consumer would be interested in. Now, like I said, going back to the example with Tyson Foods, I mean, they, you know, you go to the grocery store and you see their, you know, their package of chicken, for example, or they have, you know, countless other products like, you know, Jimmy Dean and other things that, that the consumer regularly purchases. But, you know, it's interesting that, you know, they took a, they invested at a minority share in Beyond Meat. They ultimately sold that before the IPO. But, you know, they were cognizant of the fact that, you know, look, they need to have a part in what's happening here. Now, you know, a lot of the companies, I guess, have really focused it more of their discussion on, you know, having a place at the table and having a part in this space. Now, they don't talk too much about, you know, the financial aspect and the production and that kind of thing. But, you know, they clearly are aware that the consumer cares about these things and they want to make sure that when this ultimately does shake out, that they have a place for this.
Sure. And now that I would say it's legitimized now, right? I know the second that I saw Burger King carrying, I'm not sure which one it is, and I don't want to misspeak.
Yeah, the Impossible. The Impossible.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Whopper is an institution in America, right? I mean, I can only imagine the debate that occurred in the Burger King corporate boardrooms about, you know, do we meddle with what is an icon of food in America? I mean, it's, I don't know. You have, I'm trying to think of something that is more well known and almost part of our zeitgeist than the Whopper. So now that it's legitimized, what's the next step? Are we going to see steaks? Are we going to see other forms of ground beef? We talked a little bit about chicken. Are we looking at fish next? Where do you see this going? You know, right now it's definitely, when you look at an Impossible, it looks like meat. So can they continue that? And I mean, am I going to be able to buy a filet, in a year or two that is plant-based and will have the similar textures? Could it get to that point?
Yeah, I think honestly, all of the above. You know, frankly, you know, looking at, you know, beef, which has gotten the lion's share of the attention recently, one of the arguments that the plant-based companies will tell you is that, you know, traditional beef from an animal has stayed the same, right? You can't change it really or improve it much. Whereas, you know, they can continue to improve and make their product more realistic, if you will. But but even going beyond that, you know, Beyond Meat is doing work on chicken. Impossible is said to be working on fish. Tyson Foods, that I referenced earlier, you know, invested in a company called New Wave Foods, and they're based in San Francisco, and they make plant-based shrimp.
Wow.
So I mean, there's other, you know, companies working on fish, like I said, tuna. So, you know, I mean, and you know, there's even been discussion of, you know, potentially a steak. But, you know, the advantage that beef has is, you know, when a consumer gets it and you have the patties, for example, with the Beyond Burger, they're pre-made, right? You know what to do with it. If you get some ground beef that's in a plant-based form, you know what to do with it at home. Having a chicken or fish, it's a little more difficult to prepare, takes a little more work. So the burger mm-hmm. has been a really good vehicle to kind of get the consumer on board, just because it's so simple and obvious and clear in terms of what you're going to do with it when you take it home. But, you know, these companies have basically, you know, especially Pat Brown, is the CEO of Impossible Foods, have basically said, you know, look, he wants to, you know, get rid of traditional meat as we know it. And they are, you know, they're not just going to introduce one product and rest on it. They ultimately want to, you know, promote their message of helping the environment, and waning consumer consumption of traditional meat. And that's why, you know, looking at all these other avenues, fish, chicken, tuna, among others, are just some of the pathways going forward. And, you know, I think they're, you know, wanting to do as much as they can with as many different types of meats and seafoods and chickens as they can. So, but you know, but I think, I mean, the thing I was going to say too is like a lot of these, you know, they talk about the work that they're going to be doing, but I think it's going to be probably a little while before you see something that's as complicated, say, as a steak, because, you know, you have the texture, you have the marbling and the flavor, and actually replicating that is going to be a lot more difficult, I think, than it is just to do a traditional burger, if you will. So there's a lot of complicated things that need to be done. I mean, look at, you know, with Impossible Foods, about how much time they spent doing the work on the burger that they have now. So you can imagine if something that's even potentially more complicated than a steak, how much time that's going to take to really perfect it. I mean, the risk here is that, you know, you rush something through, you know, you get it on the market and it just doesn't resonate with consumers. And say a consumer finds, you know, they try a steak and they find out, you know, look, this just doesn't compare with a traditional steak. You've arguably hurt yourself for a while because you introduced a product too soon. And, you know, go back to the point we made earlier that, you know, you want to replicate as closely as possible what a traditional meat product offers. And if you don't do that, it's going to be very difficult to attract carnivores. And frankly, that's the ultimate goal with these companies, is that, you know, they realize that, you know, vegetarians are going to consume their product and be interested in their product. But to really have a market that's scalable and accomplishes the mission of helping the environment and reducing consumption of traditional meat, they need to have a product that is as close to meat as physically possible.
Yeah, that is a great point. You had mentioned it earlier too, that, you know, this is appeals to carnivores, who are perhaps less likely to compromise. Most carnivores would taste a veggie burger and say, no, not for me. Whereas I know plenty of vegans that really truly enjoy it by now. Mm-hmm. Whereas, as you said, you get kind of one shot as a carnivore myself. If I'm gonna try a steak, if they're able to get, you know, the fibering of it done and everything so that it replicates one, you're not going to go back to that well twice, right? You're going to say, ah, this isn't like steak, and right. And very unlikely to try again. So they do really only get one crack at it. Well, you've provided a lot of insight for us today. It's absolutely fascinating. I can't think of, and maybe you can, is there an analog to this? Is there something in our food historical past that was so disruptive like this that it almost changed how you have to reimagine the food that you eat and what's potential? I know there's, you know, the bottling of things obviously, you know, changed a lot of you know, what people could take home with them. But have we seen something? I'm struggling to try and think of something that was, you know, taking what is especially this such a staple of our consumption and just completely altering it to this degree. Is there anything out there?
I mean, I'm trying to, two things come to mind. I mean, going way, way back, you know, frozen, right? And being able to freeze things. So that's one that comes to mind. And it's something that's a little more recent, you know, and focusing on the plant-based side of things too, is what happened with plant-based milks and you know, with almonds and soy and, you know, just there's several, you know, products out there that are characterizing themselves as milk. And you know, one quick point to make too, in terms of plant-based meats, is that, you know, that there are, you know, as much praise as they get and recognition they get, I mean, there are some criticisms that have been levied against them, whether it's, you know, the extensive ingredient list. For example, the Impossible Burger has 21 ingredients and the Beyond Meat Burger has 22 ingredients. And both of those examples there run counter to consumers looking for clean label and a slimmed down list of ingredients. You know, there's also, you know, concerns about maybe the aroma or the smell that the burgers give when they're cooked and lingering aftertaste. So some companies are trying to develop products that address those issues. And finally, you know, a lot of states, there's at least, you know, at least four or five of them, Mississippi, Missouri, Arkansas, and a few others that have done initiatives to basically prohibit meat terms on plant-based or even cell culture products. So, you know, that goes to the point that, you know, clearly the meat industry is you know, behind these efforts just because they don't want that term used. So, you know, frankly, going back to the point you made earlier, there's a lot of similar parallels here with what happened in plant-based milks that's now happening with plant-based meats.
Yeah. While you're speaking, I thought of perhaps another analog would be the sweetener market, artificial sugars, sweeteners, and so on. Obviously changed food forever. You know, that last point, I do want to touch on that with you before we let you go, because I know you've got a baseball game tonight to watch. We have the Brewers playing Washington tonight, I believe. So you have some preparing to do for that, I'm sure. So shed a little bit more light on that, because I know that there has been some legal battle over the word milk. In you mentioned a couple states that appear to have issue with it, where I think the argument is if the public believes that milk is from cows, then you can't use the word milk for almond milk. And is that going to be the case as well for burger? I mean, I guess veggie burger has been out there a while too, but if it looks like a duck, quacks like a duck, I expect it to be a duck. If it's red, if it's in a patty and it's called a burger, are you falsely, claiming something that it isn't? Is there a legal push going on, a pushback going on right now with that? Or is there not really anything there?
Well, I mean, you know, I think a lot of the trade groups, National Cattlemen's Beef Association and others, you know, have basically asked the FDA to implement new definitions and really define, you know, put strict parameters around plant-based meat products. And you made a good point, too, that, you know, plant-based meat products have been on the market for years and have, you know, characterized themselves as meat. But it's only in recent years that the push has really gained momentum to, you know, define what exactly a meat product is, and a lot of that, frankly, is because the plant-based meat market is growing so quickly, and these companies realize that in order to protect, their brands and protect their products, that calling it meat or you know, calling it a milk product is really important, and losing the ability to control that term and that word, there's millions of dollars at stake. Some of the plant-based meat companies, Impossible Foods and others have, you know, expressed skepticism that, you know, the consumer is confused. That's one of the arguments that some of the plant-based, meat companies have argued, that consumers are confused as to what a plant or what a meat product is. There's a lot of uncertainty at this point, and I think a lot of the groups will tell you that the FDA, that they're looking to the FDA to really define what a lot of these terms mean going forward to really clear up some of the confusion that's out there.
Mm. Well, we'll see where it heads. Since you first wrote that kind of overview article, I know that you've already written about Awesome Burger, and how they have, that's Nestle's product, has debuted as well. So I suspect that, you know, you'll be covering this space extensively moving forward. So I want to talk about how folks can find you. Of course, at fooddive.com, where you are senior editor. You're pretty much a must read on there, I would say, related to many different industries, but you certainly have your pulse on the plant-based meat one. And then I believe people can follow you on Twitter as well. Do you want to provide people with that handle?
Yeah, sure. It's just at C Deering.
Mm-hmm. And that's C D O E R I N G.
That's right.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Christopher.
Got my pleasure.
And you gave us a great overview, and I was happy that we were able to, you know, talk about a couple of the more nuanced areas as well that will get worked out over time. But certainly plant-based meat is here to stay, I would say. And, some of the biggest players in the industry have a foothold in it. I'm sure, as you mentioned, there's some startups that are going to provide interest along the way as well. And I, for one, I think that it's going to expand a lot. I think with, you know, the younger generations coming up, that maybe their habits aren't as formed as some of us are going to be open to this. And as you said, people are more and more eating food from different parts of the globe, are, you know, interested in trying different things. And I think that the palate's expanded as well. So you have the not just the taste side of it, but I think that I would call it psychologically, people are more open to things. So it'll be interesting to see how it grows.
Definitely will be. It's a fascinating area that's, you know, changing really rapidly right now.
All right. Well, we'll keep an eye on your articles on Food Dive. Thanks a lot, Christopher.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on Just a Taste, a Chef's Best production. Join us again next time as we talk to more experts in marketing, retail, and production in the food and beverage industry. You can always visit us at chefsbest.com to learn more.